In Congress, I served for almost 8 years on the Armed Services Committee.
You did run for president?
Yes. If you're not focused on serving the people, then you're focused on the wrong things. Our government exists only with the consent of the governed. We are lucky in a presidential election year if we get 50% of the American citizens to vote. I was campaigning for re-election. This was coming to the close of my first term in office. And my Hawaii National Guard Army unit was activated for deployment to Iraq. It would be an 18-month-long deployment, about a year of that spent actually in Iraq, the other months being spent training up and preparing.
Did you not have any fear and anxiety about putting yourself in that kind of harm's way?
No. We want to be people who are continuing to learn from experiences, from mistakes, from failures, from successes, from lessons learned from things other people have done. Like, that's the only way we actually be better as people, you know, husbands, wives, friends, coworkers, bosses, leaders, everything.
Welcome to the show, Tulsi.
Thank you.
I'm so honored to have you here today.
Thank you for having me. It was a happenstance meeting, unexpected, and I'm grateful that this all worked out.
You know, so am I. And before we get in, I think all of us should take a moment and say thank you for 21 years of veteran service.
Thank you. I'm the one that feels grateful to be able to serve. I'll be headed out here shortly. I'm in the U.S. Army Reserve, and I have the privilege of commanding a unit of civil affairs soldiers, and we have our 2 weeks of annual duty coming up, and I'll be taking off the civilian hat, putting on the military hat, and it's just, I've started as enlisted because of 9/11, like a lot of Americans, volunteered to deploy to the Middle East, and throughout my almost 21 years of service, I can't express in words how grateful I feel to have served alongside just such incredible people from all walks of life, from all parts of the country, people who really care and not only care for our country, but care and love each other.
Well, I think especially in today's world where there's a lot of sideline criticism.
Yeah.
Not a lot of us realize what it means for someone to dedicate their life to public service and defend this country. So we all owe you a sense of gratitude because we aren't the ones doing that. And so
thank you. I take it seriously.
Yes. But you mentioned something there. You did say when you volunteered to deploy, which is a huge thing. What was the catalyst that made you decide to actually volunteer versus being told you're going to be deployed?
Well, the first time I volunteered, there's a recurring theme here, but I was serving as a state representative in Hawaii. I was campaigning for re-election. This was coming to the close of my first term in office. And my Hawaii National Guard Army unit was activated for deployment to Iraq. It would be an 18-month-long deployment, about a year of that spent actually in Iraq, the other months being spent training up and preparing for that deployment. It was the first deployment our unit had seen since Vietnam. And so when you think about, you know, the ages and ranks of people who, filled our unit, there was like one of the older uncles who had served in Vietnam, but by and large, no one had any combat experience. And, when the unit was activated, my commander, I served in a medical unit, he called me up and he's like, hey, good news, you don't have to go because we already have someone filling the job that you're trained to do, which was essentially medical operations and logistics. And he said, you can stay home, finish running for reelection, get reelected, continue doing the work that you're doing for Hawaii. And I just knew very quickly, and we went back and forth. I told him there's no way I'm staying home and watching you guys go and ship off to the other side of the world to a war that at that time was 2004 going into 2005 was still very much the height of that war in Iraq that was billed as Operation Iraqi Freedom. And so we went back and forth. He realized I wouldn't take no for an answer. I suspended my reelection campaign to the state house, one where there wasn't any real opposition, and then went and got trained in a different job that they needed filling and went out on that that deployment. It changed my life.
I can't even imagine. I mean, did you have a sense of, I mean, obviously the sense of duty and loyalty to your division.
Yes.
But did you not have any fear and anxiety about putting yourself in that kind of harm's way?
No. And I don't say that in a way that should be misconstrued to make people think I took it lightly. I did not take it lightly at all. But I volunteered to serve my country and enlisted by choice specifically for this purpose. And I chose the National Guard so that I could serve my community in my home state during times of natural disaster, but if called to serve my country and to go after those who attacked us on that tragic day on 9/11. And so the feelings I felt were not fear and anxiety. There was definitely a sense of soberness and gravity about what we were about to do. Like I said, no one had had any recent experience in any combat environment. You know, going into a situation where you're dealing with an insurgent Islamist terrorist group that was really the one causing the casualties in the war. Yes, we trained a lot. We trained for months for this. But if anyone said, I know exactly what it's going to be like, I know exactly what's going to happen, they would have been wrong. They were still rewriting and editing and getting feedback from units that were deploying to improve the training manuals and training scenarios that we were going through. So it was a quickly evolving situation. And the real powerful thing that I don't think I fully anticipated until just before I left was just being confronted with the fact that my saying goodbye to my family could very well be my final goodbye. And I didn't gloss over that at all. I took the time to sit down and write letters to my family and express to them the things that I didn't want to left go unsaid if my time came and I didn't make that trip home.
I mean, I can't fathom having to write those letters and putting myself in that position. Did you always see yourself in the military, or was it truly the 9/11 changed that whole paradigm?
9/11 changed everything. You know, I was a kid, I grew up in Hawaii. Yeah, yes, we are the 50th state of America. Sometimes people are like, oh yeah, Hawaii was great. Now I got to go back to the States. It happens a lot. You know, we are. I mean, we're the most remote island chain in the world. And so it's easy to be removed from a lot of things. So I grew up, you know, surfing and hiking and appreciating and enjoying what it means to grow up on an island. Mm-hmm. And I cared a lot about the environment. Was really passionate about clean water. You know, get my friends, let's go clean up the beach this weekend. And that was what got me involved. That's what instigated my run for office in Hawaii. But honestly, I hadn't spent much time thinking about foreign policy or what are the threats that we're facing in the world. And 9/11 was, obviously, it was an eye-opening experience for a lot of people. And what I did know, even though I didn't think about the military, what I did know and understand and experience from a young age was that I wanted to pursue a path of service. And it started out as like, okay, well, let me start with like taking care of my neighborhood. Let me start with taking care of the beach that I love to go to as a kid. And that led to, as a teenager, starting an environmental nonprofit where cleaning up the beach is good and it's important, but it kind of gets frustrating when you go back to that beach every weekend and there's more trash. Mm-hmm. And it got me starting to think like, okay, how do I start? Like, we got to be able to do more. And so the nonprofit that I co-founded, we focused on kids like K through fourth grade. And I wrote a little fun skit called The Adventures of Water Woman. Her nemesis was Oily Al, and had a friend draw up a little coloring book. And so we took this to public schools, you know, private schools, charter schools across the state. And it was so fun for me. I played Water Woman naturally, had the blue cape with a little like bedazzled water drop on it and everything. And then, you know, there's Oily Al, and it was just cool just going through everyday things like Oily Al changed the oil in his car and he's about to dump the oil down the storm drain. Water Woman comes in the nick of time and saves the day. And just seeing the reaction in these kids' eyes as they're like, okay, here's what happens when you throw your empty soda can out of the car as you're driving down the street. Seeing them realize in their own little minds and in their own little world, the connection between like, okay, if you take this action, there's a very real consequence that affects you and your family in your lives. And seeing that light bulb go off for them was a pretty transformational experience for me to see how this little idea that I had would plant that seed in their minds, if nothing else, to think twice before doing something that they would now realize is bad for them and bad for their home and their beach and everything else.
I don't think enough young people appreciate the ripple effect.
Yes.
And that they can create big waves by small maneuvers, by just doing that,
yeah,
by impacting them at that point and putting those ideas in their head.
Right.
Can allow them to grow up into a world that is more conducive to those ideals.
Yes. And really, and I've been talking about this, the issue of individual responsibility a lot lately. And I wouldn't have thought of those words back then, but looking back at that now, while my focus was on clean water and protecting the environment, really the deeper foundational principle that I was trying to get across was exactly that. Thinking about your actions before you take actions and taking responsibility and understanding what those consequences are, and how that is such a critical principle of what it means to be a responsible member of our society.
Mm-hmm. So I get why you joined the military, the catalyst, and I understand your time in the military, but yeah, you're still in the military.
Yes.
And that is a whole different testament, because during that duration, I mean, 4 terms in the Congress, yeah, running for president, and yet you're still serving, despite the way, this is a very generalized statement, mm-hmm, but despite the way we as a country have treated our, yeah, military and the lack of appreciation that maybe is displayed at times,
right,
but yet you still serve, even though you're impacting so many in the public office. What's keeping you there?
I love it. I really, truly am grateful to be able to serve in different ways, both in uniform and outside of uniform. My deployments, I had 2 deployments to the Middle East that served as the catalyst for my wanting to run for Congress. I hadn't thought about it before. My running for State House was not at any point done within the context of, well, now I'm going to do politics for the rest of my life. It was the answer to a question that I continuously reflect on and ask myself, which is how can I best be of service? Where can I make the most impact? And being completely comfortable with the fact that, like, I've never known the answer to these generic questions we find on applications or job interviews, like, where do you see yourself in 5 years? Where do you see yourself in 10 years? Like, I don't know. And I like that I don't know, because while I have been very focused and driven with a clear sense of purpose, not being rigidly stuck to a quote unquote plan has allowed me to see and seize opportunities to serve in a lot of ways that I could not have foreseen or planned even if I had tried. I have found throughout my time in serving in uniform how, for example, in Congress, I served for almost 8 years on the Armed Services Committee, the committee that exercises, whose job it is to exercise oversight over the Department of Defense, essentially. And I know this may surprise you, Jeff, but when we have, cabinet secretaries and four-star generals coming and briefing members of Congress, they oftentimes would tell us things that they wanted us to know. Mm-hmm. And if you didn't ask the right questions or if you didn't know where to look, you might not actually find the things that really should be focused on, because they are problems that need to be addressed or changes that need to occur, even if, you know, the bureaucrats are resistant to that change. And so I saw really an ability to be more effective as a legislator, because, you know, whether in the National Guard or Reserve, I'm going out there and putting on my uniform and feeling the downstream effects of those policies and those decisions that are made. Even with the best of intentions, they can very quickly warp into something either very different or actually counterproductive once it reaches that quote-unquote end user, mm-hmm. The soldier who's just showing up for duty and waiting for somebody to tell him or her what to do. And that kind of experience has been awesome, to be able to help serve our soldiers in a different way.
Would you say the military helped shape your leadership style, or did you bring a certain style to the military and have kind of held on to that?
It has certainly shaped my approach to leadership, and has taught me some fundamentals just about how to tackle a problem, how to build a strategic plan, asking questions that, you know, you think might be simple or obvious or even dumb questions. But as I have found, some of the most high-ranking officials in our government don't ask those questions. For example, you know, obviously there's a very specific application when you're talking about the question of, do we go to war or not? But these questions really apply across the board. What is your objective? What are you trying to accomplish? What does success or winning look like? How do you define that? Because the way you define it, even given the same scenario, may be very different than I would define that. How do you know when it's time to exit? And what is that exit strategy and that exit plan? And from a U.S. government, military, diplomacy, whatever department it is, the most important question is, how does this action serve the interests of the American people? Or is it counter? Will it end up being a counterproductive action? And so these are all things, like this kind of basic analysis, these were things that I learned in the military at a very low rank, as like, okay, before you step out the door and you take your team with you, you better know the answers to these questions, because you got to tell your team so that they know everybody's moving in the same direction, on the same page, knowing that when the stuff hits the fan, as it always does in some way, shape, or form, you're able to adapt and overcome those unforeseen obstacles and continue moving towards that shared objective.
Yeah, I mean, those lessons, I think, are parallel in so many different walks of life. And the fact that you're able to learn those and apply those in your political aspirations is great, because you just hit it earlier when you said a lot of times the right questions aren't being asked. Mm-hmm. And I always wondered, why are they not being asked? And could it be that because they don't know what questions to ask, they're kind of lost in those situations? And so having that breadth of experience when a general is speaking to you, although you may never have been at that high level, even at the low level of military, you do understand the standard operating procedures of the military and how it operates.
Yes.
There is one part of the military mindset, right, which is required. Once an order has been given, you follow it. Mm-hmm. But as a politician and someone serving in the public sphere, mm-hmm. sometimes we have to question those decisions and really look at it from all the different angles. How do you juggle those two sides of that training and your own perspective?
Well, first of all, as a person who has served in the National Guard and the Reserve component, there is a very clear line between my role as a civilian or a person who's held public office or holding public office versus my role as someone who wears the uniform. So there's, it's never been a problem for me, because once I take this uniform off and put on the other one, it's about knowing my place and knowing my role and my job and what is expected of me. And so there's no bleed over or overlap. When I was in the Hawaii National Guard, for example, I would be home in Hawaii for our normal duty weekend. I would see our two-star commander there and salute him and, you know, pay due respects, and I'm doing my work. And then a couple of days later, I'd be back in Washington, D.C. in my congressional office, and he would come and pay me a visit in my office, and the roles would be very different. And he was, ma'am, how are you? And it was, some people found it strange. It wasn't strange for me, because it's just about knowing, like, hey, this is, you know, if I'm a captain, when I'm in the Army, then there's a certain place for that. And similarly, vice versa. But here's something that I think is kind of cool as the generational shift goes on. Yes, ultimately, when you're given an order, you will execute the order. But I'll just speak. I am currently a commander of a battalion of close to 200 soldiers. I'm a lieutenant colonel. And one of my first, I think it was my first day on the job, I was introducing myself, talking to my soldiers, and there was a young sergeant, like a E5, not very high rank, probably been in the Army maybe 3-4 years at most. And I was talking about a certain mission and this is what's going on. And she raised her hand. She's like, why are we doing it? Why? Like, why is this important for us to focus on? What good does it bring to the country? That's a very important question. And I'm glad you asked, because we are not as strong as we could be if we have just a bunch of blind followers. And it kind of goes back to, but you know, a generation ago, you could get screamed at for saying, why are we doing this?
But is it appropriate to ask that question in a military setting?
Yes, that's my point.
At all times?
In a different, if you're under fire and the commander is like, let's go this way now, it's not the time or place to be like, well, hey, let's discuss this for a minute here.
As an entrepreneur, I know how meaningful it is to invest in the people and causes that are close to me. And on GoFundMe, it's easy, safe, and powerful to do just that. Whether you're supporting a family member, friend, local business, or charity. And whenever you make a donation, you're protected by the GoFundMe Giving Guarantee. Visit GoFundMe.com today to help make a positive difference in your community.
Yeah, so time and place, circumstance dependent, but in a previous generation of the military, that would not be encouraged. It would be looked down upon or even reasoned for some, you know, some good physical fitness, disciplinary yes. action. But I'm encouraged that with a younger generation, a newer generation coming in, while some may see it as insubordinate and, you know, how you deliver those questions matters. I've found it as a positive thing, because I want soldiers who are thinking about things, thinking themselves, how to tackle a problem set, being able to communicate to other people, why are we doing this? But I think even at a deeper level, people in the National Guard and Reserve, they have professions. I have a clinical psychologist with like 2 PhDs. We have EMTs, we have firefighters, we have police officers, we have college students, we have moms and dads, we have people who are small business owners, people who are very, very successful in their civilian life. I believe it's an awesome thing that they choose to dedicate what turns out to be a minimum of like 47 days a year out of their year, one weekend out of every month, and then 2 weeks a minimum. Usually they end up doing a lot more, to set their family aside, to set their school aside, to set their jobs aside, and come in and serve our country. And it's a big deal. And I want them to know that there is real value to that sacrifice that they are making. And so I have encouraged and created an environment where those kinds of questions are welcome and that kind of discussion is welcome. And I think that's the bigger picture thing that we're seeing lacking in a lot of our society in the age of, you know, quick scrolling social media. A lot of that critical thinking goes out the window, and you just like, oh, okay, I saw a tweet, I saw a headline, I was like, oh wow, okay, we shouldn't take things at face value. We should actually exercise our brains and figure out what's really going on.
I mean, you're right, but because of the realization of where we're at today,
yeah,
with that, how we consume and get our information and what we now hold as our truths, mm-hmm. doesn't that concern you a little bit to have an eclectic group of people from all different backgrounds, yeah. as you said, consuming information very differently, but not actually going very deep, right? It's a mile wide and an inch deep mm-hmm. of how they're getting their source of truth, challenging, questioning. Because what if you have two different people in under your command mm-hmm. ask the same question and differ on whether or not the value is in the mission, and now you have potential, you know, concern amongst your ranks or trepidation.
Yeah.
How do you kind of unite everybody when you have such an eclectic group with all of these different perspectives?
Yeah. It's a really great question. And I think it speaks to the whole debate around speech, first of all. There are some who say that our speech, free speech, should be limited. You know, you have this whole misinformation and disinformation, and who should be platformed, who should not be allowed to be platformed, all of these different discussions. I am a firm believer in free speech, and that bad speech or misinformed speech, offensive speech even, is best defeated by superior speech, by more informed speech. And so in your scenario that you're pointing out, when I may have different soldiers, and I do, who have differing views on certain things, or may not agree with the purpose statement that I've given them, there is a time, and this, again, this is the military, it's a very structured organization for a reason. And frankly, when you're in uniform, you do give up some of your freedoms. And so I find it to be a healthy exercise to be able to openly have these discussions instead of squashing them and telling people, okay, like they're going to have the discussion anyway. So let's have the discussion together and feel free to question what I'm telling you and saying, well, does that make sense? Well, why is it that versus this? Having that, we get to a better place where they know they've been heard. We've talked about it. Maybe they've brought something that I haven't considered before, which has happened. Hey, this is the experience that I have. This is how I think it applies. And ultimately, we get to a place where the commander says, awesome, great discussion. This is the direction we are going. This is why we are doing it. It's time to execute. And then it's go.
So taking that and extrapolating it out to the public world.
Yes.
The non-military side.
Yes.
You did run for president.
Yes.
If I remember, you were down to the final three.
Yes.
In 2020 on the Democratic side. And one of the things that I always appreciated, regardless of what side of the aisle anyone sits, mm-hmm. is you had, and you spoke publicly about people over party.
Yeah.
And you're not going to just say something because the team you're on happened to do that, which in a way is kind of that same military example.
Yeah.
Brought out. Because mm-hmm. although it's not the military, there was certain talking points on both sides. And if yes. you're part of that party, you're supposed to fall in line.
And there are consequences if you don't.
There are. Mm-hmm. And there's consequences if you do.
That's true.
Right?
That's very true.
So I always appreciated that about you and your approach. What was your intention, knowing you were part of a party and knowing you were, in a way, going against them during that time? Let's pretend mm-hmm. you won.
Mm-hmm.
What was going to be the back end of that? How were you going to drive kind of that new approach to politics and leadership and, yeah. and serving our country? What was the intention and goal there? And was it to break those old static party lines on both sides and really turn it into more of a fluid party?
It was a desire to be in a position where I could actually... in this specific example, I was trying to be a little bit more broad, but in this specific example, I saw a National Democratic Party that I felt had strayed so far away from its principles that drew me to be a Democrat in the first place 20 plus years ago. The party that I joined, I was attracted to because I saw a party of the people. I saw a party that would actually fight for the well-being of the little guy. I saw a big tent party that welcomed people with different views, encouraged discussion, defended free speech, even for those who said things that were horrible and highly offensive. A party that understood the importance of civil rights and civil liberties, that celebrated people like President JFK and Martin Luther King, and not just because of the iconic leaders that they were, but because of what made them iconic, with the kind of like serious disruptive change they sought to bring about and the courage that they embodied. And so, throughout my time in Congress, I served as a vice chair of the Democratic National Committee for a few years. And when I was running for president, I spoke about how, the president ultimately is the de facto leader of their party. My desire to bring the Democratic Party back to those principal foundations that drew me to the party in the first place, because of my concern that I saw the leadership of the party was becoming one of the elite versus the people, that was more inward looking rather than outward looking, that was increasingly trying to get people to conform rather than encouraging diversity of thought. I felt that they were focusing on the wrong things. And by ultimately, what are the wrong things? If you're not focused on serving the people, then you're focused on the wrong things.
Yeah. I mean, it's fair. And you clearly made a public decision to leave the party. And before we talk about the upcoming book.
Yeah.
How, I guess this is one last leadership question before we touch on that. But how do you see us solving the huge divisive polarizing place we find America in today, when it seems identity politics and everyone's speaking to that one point on both sides, and you don't see any way for the middle to bring us back? Mm-hmm. Is it one of those things in your mind where eventually we're going to snap back just because you can only go so far apart? Or is there a path you see that you're pushing for to help us do that?
There is a path. and that is really at the crux of why I wrote this book. It's called For Love of Country, Leave the Democrat Party Behind. And it speaks to the experiences that I've had. I'm specific in this book, in the words that I choose. I'm not speaking about all Democrats. There are a lot of Democrats that I've personally heard from in the country who share the same frustrations that I've been through and that I've felt with the direction that the leadership of the party has chosen to take. And it's really not a book about partisan politics. Obviously, I talk a lot about the Democratic Party because I was in it for over 20 years and now I've left it and become an independent. I also talk about some of the serious problems with the Republican Party and some of the leaders in that party, with the political system as a whole, that in Washington, it is like a bubble. And people care more about, well, what do the reporters think? Or what do the lobbyists think? Or am I getting invited to this party? And, oh my gosh, I'm not popular anymore. And they left me off the guest list for this other fancy embassy party. And just, it's like, if that's what you're worried about when you're walking through those historic halls where literally, if you've never been to the U.S. Capitol before, you should go and take a tour. And walking up those marble stairs in the U.S. Capitol, you can see the grooves in that marble. And I've often imagined, like, man, the people who have come before us for generations into this place that is rightfully known as the people's house. And yet, sadly, we have so many politicians from both parties who are more concerned about the next election than they are about the people. And when you talk about hyper-partisanship, too often when the parties do come together, it is most often around the cause of starting another war. without thinking through, hey, is this actually good? Is this necessary? Have we exhausted all other possible means of diplomacy before resorting to either economic warfare or kinetic warfare, either with our troops or a proxy force, asking the most essential and important questions. And ultimately, this leads to not only a less safe country and a greater security threat, but a power grab taking away our freedom. And so I point out a lot of big problems in this book, but most importantly, I talk about where there's hope. We won't accidentally come together as a country as a reaction of the extremes that are very real. The only way we come together is if we choose to come together. And the path for how to do that is really laid out by our founding fathers, people who disagreed about a lot of things. There's this thing that people think like, oh, well, I don't agree with this person. And so like, why bother have a conversation? Have a conversation. You might learn a thing or two. You know, the Democratic Party, unfortunately, now is like got a lot of purity tests. Like if you're not 100% on all of this laundry list of issues, then you don't belong here. That's not how we are in life. Why would we expect politicians to be that way? Why would we want them to be that way? We don't want a country of people who are robots and think alike and act alike and walk in lockstep out of fear of some kind of cancellation consequence. We need this open marketplace of ideas. We need to treat each other with respect, even when we disagree. Have those fierce debates, even arguments around the things that you're passionate about and that you really care about, but come together in the same way that our founders did around the fundamental principles and freedoms enshrined in the Constitution, enshrined in the Bill of Rights, enshrined in the Declaration of Independence. Because if we don't find our way to come together as fellow Americans first, then we will very quickly find ourselves in a place, as we already are seeing signs that we are headed in a direction where these freedoms are being eroded and taken away by those who only care about power. And if we do nothing, we will wake up one day and wonder, how did this happen? How did these United States of America become a country that resembles more of a banana republic than an actual democratic republic?
But isn't that a lot? Don't we struggle with the boiling frog problem here? Because while everything you just laid out is 100% true, we do need the population to spend the time, energy, and effort to A, understand the problems, yes. B, not only just consume the this is what I want to hear media,
yes.
which is what we now have,
yes.
regardless of political side. And it's dangerous in business, it's dangerous in life when you assume you have all the facts because mm-hmm. you heard it from one source that may or may not have intention behind right. delivering that.
Or be credible.
Or be credible. So how can we help? Because I travel speaking around the country, yeah. opening Everbowls, and I meet great humans.
Yes.
And that's what I've learned. Even though I live in Southern California, people all over the country, good humans, good people, are so politically divided because that's their community.
Yeah.
And they're a product of that. Mm-hmm. And so how do we grassroot this? Because it's not going to come from the top.
Yeah.
Because as you said, power begets more power yeah. and they have a motive. How can we actually touch these communities to showcase where those founding fathers delivered the path forward and how we have to get reunited yeah. and become the United States of America yeah. that we once were and hopefully will remain. How do we actually break down to that level?
I am doing all that I can. Mm-hmm. I am on the road almost constantly delivering this message.
It's why
I wrote the book. Thank you for inviting me here to join you today. But no single person or single organization can accomplish this. Thankfully, there are a lot of other folks who are rightfully concerned about our freedoms being under assault and who are doing the same. And that's the challenge that I pose in the book. And it's the challenge I pose whether I'm speaking to Democrats or Republicans or Libertarians or Independents or whomever the audience is. The challenge is, if you don't like what's happening, look in the mirror. ask yourself, how can I be of service? How can I do more? What action can I take to save our country and to defend our freedom? And so there's no easy, clean path to get there. But like you experience in your travels, it's what I've experienced when it's what gave me hope when I ran for president, even in the midst of a very crazy, dark political environment. Man, I had like 4 or 5 town halls a day on any given day in any given part of the country. And it was such an amazing and inspiring experience because our country is filled with incredible humans who really do care for each other, and they care for their community, they care for their family, they care for our country. And in my situation, they were coming together in those spaces because they wanted to be a part of the solution, but maybe weren't quite sure how. I have faith and hope that if we are able to spread the truth and sound the alarm about the realities that we face today, that enough Americans will be spurred to take action. How do we defend our freedoms? By exercising our freedoms, by not self-censoring because you're afraid of what the consequences could be. And obviously by not only going and casting your vote when it comes time to do so, but being informed before you go and know that, hey, our job is to hold leaders accountable. We can only do that if we put in the work to know what exactly they're doing. And are they for us or are they for themselves? There's no easy path. There's no easy answer. We go back to where we started from with those kids. Mm. It's about individual responsibility and taking ownership of the power that those who founded this country placed in our hands, which is a pretty incredible thing when you really think about it. You know, that we the people, wow, like those are powerful words. They said that our government exists only with the consent of the governed. And so while we can rail away all day and night, justifiably so, about how, you know, government bureaucracy and just all that is broken. It really is broken in a lot of our government systems. Got it. Those people are elected by voters. And the reality is that we are lucky in a presidential election year if we get 50% of the American citizens to vote.
Hey, fitness fans, ready to crush your fitness goals? Make your move to EOS Fitness, where becoming a member starts at just $9.99 a month. Gyms are open 24/7 and packed with the latest gym equipment to keep your workouts fresh. What are you waiting for? Give them a call, drop by, or hit up jefffenster.com/EOS to join. EOS Fitness, better gym, better price. Now, let's get after those goals.
That's fascinating.
It's fascinating and sad. It really is sad.
But it's also yourself excluded at a time and place where a lot of the people you talk to say this sentence, I would never want that job.
Yes.
And which means some of our most qualified potential candidates will never raise their hand and say, I'm willing to take the beating to go through that process.
Yeah.
And so not to
those
say
those are the people, by the way, when I meet them, I'm like, you are the one who should run. Because the politicians that I've met, and I know many of them personally, the ones who chase those parties, they chase the title, they chase the special treatment that they get, they're the ones who should never be in power. It's the unwilling leader and servant, someone with a servant's heart, who's willing to do it in spite of the fact that they have no desire to, and are willing to bear those sacrifices of scrutiny and judgment and attacks and all of the things that go along with it because they are driven by a love of country and recognize that the people in this country need real leaders who have their best interests at heart.
So is the spirit for love of country to be the starting point of a paradigm shift for America? Or is it more to help us open our eyes? Like, what do you want people to take after they read your book?
I want people to have the opportunity to be reminded of what it means to be an American and the vision that our founders had for our country, the vision that Martin Luther King had for our country, and our potential. We have to be able to see the truth and identify the problem in order to be able to be that instigator of change and problem solving. The takeaway here is there is no single individual that will come and solve this problem that faces us as a country. It is up to every one of us as Americans, to own that responsibility and take action ourselves.
It's a great cause because you're tackling big issues.
Yes.
And you've clearly identified it correctly. It starts with us all being self-aware and accountable.
Yes.
Because we can't solve it from the top down. It has to be solved from the bottom up.
Yes.
There's a time frame for that.
Yes.
That also doesn't happen overnight.
No.
And there is a major paradigm shift in how technology is serving us as a world today.
Yeah.
Nations have way more access to the populace of other countries, mm-hmm. obviously from immigration and all of the major issues that we are tackling as a country and AI and all these different elements. Is there a scenario where you see the grassroots happening, as you're mentioning, but could it come, should it come from politicians, or should it come at the local level? Because I read your book. Thank you for the giving me some color
Thank
so
you.
I can read it.
Yeah.
It's a fascinating read. I loved a lot of the things you said and how you said it, because you did point out so many different areas that maybe are forgotten.
Yes.
And how we take the lens of our forefathers hundreds of years ago and apply it to today's problems.
Yes.
That is where I see it, a huge challenge, but a huge mm-hmm. opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can help drive that, and I'm curious your thoughts on how we help achieve that. Because the government telling us to do it in whichever party,
yeah.
no one's listening.
No.
No one's taking that to heart.
Yeah.
So how can we accomplish that in your eyes, knowing that you've clearly identified the path yeah. forward and the problem?
Yeah.
How can we implement it? And how can the audience who's listening today, what can they do immediately to say, okay, after I read this book, what's the next step? What do I actually do?
So the very specific steps that people can take, for example, after they read this book, is to then recognize that every one of us is a person of influence, whether we realize it or not. People think like, well, if I don't have a podcast, or you know, I'm not a business owner, I'm just a mom, or just a this, or just a that. Every one of us has a sphere of influence that's probably a lot bigger than we may realize. And so scroll through your phone and look at all the people in your phone and start thinking about how you can have this conversation with them. See where their head's at. What are they thinking about? Maybe they're like already on it and they're like, yeah, cool, let's join forces. Or maybe they're one of those people who understandably says, I hate politics. I don't even know if I should waste my time voting because it's just a waste of time. The thing is irredeemably broken. There's an opportunity to start have some real dialogue. Maybe share your copy of the book so that you can start talking through these challenges and how you can join forces. This is about, this has to happen through the grassroots and organically by everyone. When we talk about taking individual responsibility, yes, obviously the first step is getting informed and casting your vote, but that's not enough. We got to take all of our people with us mm-hmm. On this crusade for peace and freedom, security and prosperity, you know, which is actually kind of a perfect way for this change to take place. Because as you said, no government official can come in and say, okay, you will do this, you will do that. We don't have mandatory voting for a reason. We need to see that opportunity for what it is and connect it to the things and people that we care about most. I've got friends who I know, some who serve in the military, which I'm always surprised by when they say, well, I don't vote. It's like, wow, you, even privately, you can directly impact somebody making decisions about where you go, how you live, how your family is taken care of. But even when we're talking about things like school choice, for example, parents having the ability to choose where their child goes to school versus saying, well, because you live in this zip code, you will send your child to this school, whether it's a good school or a bad school. We've got to get away from this idea that all children are the same and learn the same and should be treated like, you know, products on a conveyor belt where you push them in one end and you get a good product on the other end. And it's just not how people are. Right. Parents know their children best and should have the freedom to be able to choose what education style would work best for each of their children. This is a policy or an issue that polls show increasingly over time. People across all political partisan demographics, ethnic demographics, age demographics, nearly 80% of parents across America would like to have this freedom to choose how to best educate their children, and yet they don't in most places. There are political powers that be that are standing in the way of that for their own selfish interests. But this is one example of how someone who says, I hate politics, and I get it, trust me, I get it. But when you're thinking about what's best for your children, there's a direct connection between your ability to have that freedom as a parent and what kind of people you vote for in office, or if you don't vote at all. And I could give you 100 examples of those direct through lines between things that impact you on a day-to-day basis or those that you love and care about the most, and how politicians at every level of government are directly impacting your life positively or negatively. We cannot separate politics from life.
Right.
It is reality. And our founders recognized the fragile nature of democracy, how humans with power are unfortunately sometimes prone to abuse that power. And that's why we have the system of governance that we have, but it only works if we, the people, actually exercise our power and use it.
Yeah, and I challenge everyone who's listening and who's watching on all the different platforms to buy your book, because it is a refreshing perspective, even if they disagree with you on your politics. I believe it was Albert Einstein said, you can't solve the problems by using the same logic you use to create them.
Yes.
And so we have to stay informed.
Yes.
And we have to be open to other ideas, because as I said at the beginning, and what I loved about you in your political journey the most was you always said people over party instead of party first. And a lot of our politicians are party first, and nobody agrees with 100% of their party.
No.
Nobody does.
No.
And so we do need to tackle each issue on its face. And that is true in business. Mm-hmm. And these principles, these leadership qualities that you're bringing to the American people from the political sphere can be applied to all of us, entrepreneurs, CEOs, managers, VPs, and everyone up and down, and even in the family unit, which is, we believe this to be true, but let's take new information.
Yes.
Let's attack that problem from a different perspective and see if we still agree with ourselves. And if we do, great.
Yeah.
Right. If someone reads your book and still disagrees with everything you said, that's okay.
It is.
But they're informed.
Absolutely. I mean, everything you said, I 100% agree with. And it's the thing is, it makes sense. Like, it's just common sense that in our personal relationships, in work, in life, we want to be people who are continuing to learn from experiences, from mistakes, from failures, from successes, from lessons learned from things other people have done. Like, that's the only way we actually be better as people, you know, husbands, wives, friends, coworkers, bosses, leaders, everything. Why would we expect something different in the political sphere or when it comes to conversations around politics? I've been around this for a long time. I am always eager. I will listen to podcasts from people who I already know from the outset I'm not going to agree with, but I'm really curious about why they hold a position that I think just doesn't make sense at all. Like, what is your rationale? What's the logic you're using behind this? And I hope you have some. Sometimes there's not, but usually, you know, they talk, which is the great thing about podcasts. You have the chance to actually explore these things, and I always gain new information. And sometimes it's caused me to think like, oh, wow, that's an angle on this that I've never really thought about. And whether it changes my position or reinforces my position, but allows me to strengthen my argument in a conversation or in a debate, we individually and collectively get to a better place when we are challenging ourselves first and the positions that with others who we may disagree with. Because I've seen it through my work in Congress. By remaining open-minded, treating people with respect, and actually listening, truly listening, we have found solutions to things that neither of us would have found individually at all. And it was because we came at it from two very different perspectives.
Yeah. And I think that there's an opportunity on your website right now, if someone pre-orders it, to actually get a signed copy ahead of the release.
You'll get a discount and a signed copy. The book officially publishes April 30th. I just found out that it's done being printed and they're at the warehouse now. So if you go to TulsiGabbard.com, you can order the book there. You can get a signed copy with a discount. If you prefer to go through Amazon.com, the books are available for pre-order and it will be in your mailbox on April 30th.
Which is exciting. I'm going to as well because I want a signed copy.
Thank you.
And are you ready?
I would have one for you, but nope. I don't. I haven't even gotten a copy of the book yet. So
I want to contribute.
Thank you.
I appreciate you coming on because it's rare. You know, I have a lot of CEOs and athletes and celebrities on, you know, on my show, and we talk about different elements of success and what drives them to be successful. And you just hit on so many of the same traits. And it's all about defining your core values and how you live and breathe them on a daily basis. And again, whether someone agrees or disagrees politically, that doesn't matter. It's the same in my business. You can agree on my decision-making or not, but if I understand how you approach problems and what your intention and spirit is behind it, I can agree that I appreciate your path regardless if I don't always agree on all the policies. Mm-hmm. And that's not me speaking. I'm saying that abstractly.
Yes.
And it's true in all things. And so your openness and your desire to always put the people of America first, your commitment and dedication to serving in the military and in Congress and take the wild path of running for president and putting yourself out there to be attacked and from every angle, like all president candidates go through. Before we hit rapid fire though, will you ever do it again?
I don't know. I don't know. If there is an opportunity where I can go and make the kind of truly transformational change that I believe in this country, I would chase that opportunity.
I will just kind of see it in 4 years. There will be a legacy shift of the names we're very accustomed to at the top of all the tickets, not being eligible to be at the top of all the tickets.
That's an interesting point.
So there will be a bunch of new names on there. Just saying.
Abstractly, of course.
So you ready for a little rapid fire?
Yes, let's go.
All right, so you're going to stare into camera one.
All right.
I'm going to ask you four questions.
Okay.
Quick answers, under a minute if you can, but really just what best serves the response that comes.
Okay.
Number one, how do you define the word aloha?
Aloha is a powerful word that doesn't mean hello or goodbye. It's not a greeting, but we use it as a word to greet each other. Because of its spiritual meaning. Alo means to share, and ha is a reference to the eternal life force that exists within every one of us. And so when you greet someone with aloha, you are really recognizing that we are spiritually connected. We are all children of God. And by seeing each other in that way, we can get past all of the labels and the noise and the presumptions and all this stuff that tends to get in the way of having a truly meaningful, substantive exchange. And this is why we greet each other with aloha.
What is your greatest lesson in leadership?
Be humble and lead with a servant's heart. I've had people argue that to be a servant leader is a contradictory concept. I wholeheartedly disagree. In order to lead, one must do so truly with a servant's heart that cares for, inspires, and teaches those who they've been charged to lead in any circumstance.
What is your secret to keeping composure under pressure?
Remain spiritually grounded in my purpose and know exactly who you are, and that generally those who are attacking you are doing so based on their own insecurities and their own fears, and they don't actually care about you, nor should you care about their interests. For me, in a very personal way, doing my best to live a life that's pleasing to God is the most important thing to me. And so through the drama and the chaos and the criticism and harshness and toxicity of politics, especially in Washington, living my life in a way where I can best be pleasing to God and try to love God, that's all that matters. That's all that matters to me.
And finally, if you could have dinner with someone who's no longer alive, who would it be and why?
I would love to have dinner with Dr. Martin Luther King, specifically because he lived through a time of greater adversity than many of us could ever even possibly imagine. And yet he was disciplined in his message of peace, delivering inspiration to people about how we can come together, not based on the color of our skin or any other superficial label, but instead as children of God, understanding we are all equal.
Well, Tulsi, I want to thank you so much for coming on today.
Thank you, Jeff.
And for all the hard work that you're doing, not only to serve this country, but to also change it and be the voice for the little guy and girl out there and hold all parties accountable to their values that they speak publicly or what they should be. And the fact that you are going around the country, meeting everyday Americans, fighting for all of us and trying to effect change in the manner with which you're doing, and for writing this book, which I think is going to be a great voice in the space that needs to be read and heard.
Thank you.
And so thank you so much. This was really an awesome experience for me.
Thank you. I am so grateful we crossed paths and that we had this opportunity to really dig into the things that you talk about on your show on a regular basis. I've enjoyed being here and learning more about Everbowl and what sparked this mission of yours to help help people be empowered to make better choices for themselves and their loved ones. And I am leaving here inspired by our conversation, because I don't care whether you are, it doesn't matter what industry you're in or what profession you're in, or whether you are a mom raising incredible kids, or a dad for that matter, a teacher, a business owner, whatever it is, each of us has the opportunity to lead and to spark that change. And it's an incredible thing to see how you are doing that with your life.
Well, thank you. And for our audience, I really do recommend that you immediately go to TulsiGabbard.com. You get a copy of this book. I read it. There are so many lessons in leadership that you're going to be able to apply to your business or to your entrepreneurial journey, to your families. You articulate it so well as holding ourselves and our establishment accountable to what we say we can expect them to be. So please go do that, because learning is the foundation of future success. Follow Tulsi on her journey. And thank you so much for coming on the Jeff Fencer Show.
Thank you, Jeff.
Hey, everyone. First, I want to thank all of you for tuning in. And if you guys haven't heard about my new book, Relationship Bank Account, click the link in the show notes or search the title on Amazon. This book is packed with all my secrets to success in both relationships and life. Make sure to pick up a copy, and if the book helps you on your journey, let us know by leaving a review. I appreciate all of you and can't wait to see you on the next one.